North America in 1492 was not a virgin wilderness, but a network of indigenous nations, peoples of the corn, says Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz in An Indigenous People's History of the United States. These were civilizations based on advanced agriculture and featuring polities, she says. And as she describes, North America was densely populated at the end of the 15th century. Indigenous nations spanned the entire Western Hemisphere with a population of around 100 million people. Some 40 million of those people lived in North America. For reference, the population of Europe at the same time was roughly the same at about 50 million people. The reason, maybe one of the reasons for this incredibly healthy, dense population in the Western Hemisphere is no doubt due in part to advances in medicine and agriculture. People enjoyed good health due to practices of herbal medicine, dentistry, even surgery, and practiced good hygiene with regular bathing, among other things. Their diet was healthy, a mostly healthy vegetarian one, based on corn with some wild fish and meat included, and based on a respectful relationship with the land. From coast to coast, the land was well cared for and filled with farms, sophisticated irrigation systems, and well-cultivated and managed forests. People organized themselves into self-governing nations, city-states, and towns, all connected by a vast system of roads and trade routes. A traveler at this time, for example, could go between the northeastern part of the continent all the way to the west coast and back on these roads. So why do so many Americans today still live under the false impression that America was some kind of sparsely populated virgin wilderness at the time of European arrival? Perhaps because it is easier than facing the truth and taking responsibility for it. The land was not free for the taking. The pilgrims were maybe brave pioneers, as we like to think, and they were squatters practicing settler colonialism. And all the settler colonizers who followed into North America engaged in theft and genocide in order to take the land. Sometimes we even hear things that soften the story for us, things like, well, it wasn't people who did so much of the killing. It was the European diseases brought into North America. But that, too, is a convenient lie. Diseases certainly played their part, but white Europeans did most of the killing with their own hands. This is a hard truth. And so, rather than face the truth of our history, America has created an entire mythology around it, and especially around Native Americans. It's a story that white people like to tell ourselves so that we don't have to face the truth. And a big piece of this story is coming around again, as it does every year at this time, when American Thanksgiving is celebrated. Part of the myth is that what happened between the European squatters and Native Americans was some kind of tale of cooperation, that the Native Americans warmly greeted the pilgrims and they all sat down to a celebratory feast that for some reason involves turkey, which is most likely not at all the case, but that made it into the story too. That made it into the false narrative. This is a false narrative. As Dunbar Ortiz says, this idea of the gift-giving Indian helping to establish and enrich the development of the United States is an insidious smokescreen meant to obscure the fact that the very existence of this country is a result of the looting of an entire continent and its resources. No wonder Thanksgiving is a difficult day of remembrance and mourning for our Indigenous siblings. As Indigenous scholar Jody Bird writes, the story of the New World is horror, the story of America a crime. North America itself is a crime scene. Many of you in this congregation know this. Many of you have been researching and learning about Indigenous and Black and Brown history for a while now. But for people hearing this truth for the first time about our history, or I should say, rather, unlearning the myths that we were all taught, it can be an emotional process. One of the emotions that seems to come up real fast for white folks is guilt and then paralysis. I've certainly felt those things as well. Sometimes I still do. And I feel particularly stuck now, knowing what I know at this point about the history of what happened here on North American soil and the lengths to which settler colonizers have gone to cover up the truth. I have certainly feel that way when it comes to the question of where do we go from here? I can feel a little paralyzed at times because it's just such a big question. And so as I was reading the Indigenous Peoples' History of the United States, I kept going faster, and I was really wanting to get to the part of the book where Dunbar Ortiz would tell us what to do now and how to heal. That after hundreds of pages detailing Indigenous people's history, she offers but one brief and incredibly powerful paragraph that I want to share with you today. She says, "Indigenous people offer possibilities of life after empire, possibilities that neither erase the crimes of colonialism nor require the disappearance of the original peoples colonized under the guise of including them as individuals. That process rightfully starts by honoring the treaties the United States made with Indigenous nations, by restoring sacred sites, starting with the Black Hills and including most federally held parks and land and all stolen sacred items and body parts, and by payment of sufficient reparations for the reconstruction and expansion of Native nations." That is a dense paragraph. Honoring the treaties, restoring sacred sites, reparations, reconstruction and expansion of Native nations. I am fully on board with these suggestions and will work to see them through to the best of my ability. But I have to admit, it took me some time to get to the point where I could hear these well-articulated truths and take them seriously. I just didn't have enough information. I just had the American myth still rattling around in the back of my mind, and I didn't know better. For example, I was 25 years old before I even heard about the horror of Indian boarding schools. I don't know how that happened. How does somebody get to be that old and not know something like that? I was in a community class with an Anishinaabe elder who had spent his childhood in a boarding school, and he told me about it. He told me his story. And I still wonder, how does someone get through high school and college, get to be in their mid-20s before they know this truth, or really anything about Indigenous people's history? A people without knowledge of their past history, origin, and culture is like a tree without roots, Marcus Garvey says. So here we are. In order to move forward, to honor the treaties, to restore sacred sites, to pay sufficient reparations, to reconstruct and expand Native nations, we need to know our history. We need to know the truth. For white Americans, this mostly means listening to the truth-telling of Indigenous people, Black people, and people of color in this nation, people who have been trying to tell us for a long time now, but we just weren't listening. And this year has brought an extra wrinkle in the truth-telling world, hasn't it? The concept of truth has somehow become a controversial topic in recent years, hasn't it? We live in an age now with words like truthiness and alternative facts in our cultural vocabulary. We have a commander-in-chief who unabashedly lies to us every day. We have fake news and deep fakes. We have conspiracy theories and incredible levels of denial in this country. The truth is under attack, and yet truth matters. Above all, truth matters. Every Sunday, we remind ourselves of this when we say together our shared covenant. As a people, we seek the truth in love. We seek the truth in love. As Unitarian Universalists, we affirm and promote a free and responsible search for truth and meaning because truth matters. As my colleague, the Reverend Mark Ward, said in a sermon in 2017, as you use, we believe that our spiritual wholeness depends on confronting the real facts of our lives and the world we live in. We believe we can live free, awakened, and aware. We can be loving, compassionate, and kind. We can live into who we are and use our gifts to help save the world only in the presence of the truth. The truth matters. The truth is an important part of our faith. And yes, the truth is under attack in 2020. And so we must do our part. Now more than ever, we need to stay committed to seeking the truth in love, to listening deeply for truth, to grounding our faith in truth-telling, to staying connected with the truth that abides across time and culture, the truth of the Spirit. I know it feels overwhelming, and especially now in the madness of 2020, but I am hopeful today because we are living in a time when people are stepping up and bravely telling their truth. And even better, people are finally listening, learning from it, and engaging in meaningful action. The Me Too movement, the Black Lives Matter movement, the Indigenous Peoples movement. In 2020 alone, we have seen some remarkable things. For example, I have seen Juneteenth get more attention than I can ever recall. I've noticed more and more people this past year letting go of Columbus Day and celebrating Indigenous Peoples Day instead. The Washington football team changed its name. Columbus statues have been toppled around the country, and the Supreme Court voted to honor the treaty which created the Creek Nation Reservation in 1866. And I know that there is more. Truth is being told in 2020 if you are willing to listen for it. So I've been wondering, are we at a turning point? As politics in this nation have gotten uglier in recent years and white nationalism has been on the rise, I have been wondering if this is it. If this is the last desperate gasp of a dying white supremacy. If this is our chance to end white supremacy once and for all. If this is the time when we honor the treaties, restore the land, pay adequate reparations, restore Native nations, heal America, heal the earth, and heal her people. If this is the moment, if this is the national reckoning that Ta-Nehisi Coates talks about when he describes a national reckoning that would lead to spiritual renewal. A national reckoning that would lead to spiritual renewal, a revolution of the American consciousness, a reconciling of our self-image as the great democratizer with the facts of our history, with the truth. Now, of course, I know it would be impossible for any one person to bring about a national reckoning and a revolution of the American consciousness. And I know that it's hard to keep the faith when the work ahead of us is so large and looks so daunting. None of us alone can do this. But each of us can do our part, no matter how small. I, for one, will start very small. I will continue to educate myself. I will teach my daughter about Indigenous history. I will tell her the truth about, for example, Indian boarding schools before she's in her mid-20s. I will share stories with her of Native survival, resistance, and hope. I will dig into my own family history and take responsibility for it, including the fact that, among other things, I'm descended from the Scotch-Irish, known to be some of the most brutal settler colonizers in the early days of American colonialism. What you choose to do is up to you. But everyone is needed if we're going to heal our nation, our earth, and her people. It is all possible if we face the truth, learn our history, take responsibility for it, and act accordingly. I want to leave you this morning with a quote from my colleague, the Reverend Ashley Horan, who said in a sermon last year, "True healing, spiritual, emotional, material healing of the wounds created by white supremacy can only begin after we stop actively doing violence, which is where reparations come in. We cannot create a just and equitable society for all people until we stop the harm of generational wealth hoarding, stolen labor, and land theft from Black and Brown and Indigenous communities. Yes, real reparations have to be systemic. We need a mass-scale shift of resources and investment, which none of us in this room have the power to bring to fruition right now. But if we acknowledge that racism isn't our fault, but it is our responsibility, we can begin in tiny, hyper-local ways to plant the seeds of the national reckoning that will lead to a spiritual renewal. Is this our moment? Is this it? Find whatever it is that is yours to do. Know the truth. Plant tiny seeds now that will grow into a better tomorrow. Together, we can heal this nation. May this be so. May we be the ones to make it so.